This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a real pleasure for me to have in the studio Mark Bamuthi Joseph, one of the most accomplished spoken word artists in America, a National Poetry Slam champion. He's also a playwright and an educator. He's acted in Tony Award-winning plays on Broadway. He's been a featured artist on Russell Simmons' Deaf Poetry on HBO, and he served as the artistic director of Russell Simmons Presents Brave New Voices. Mark Bamuthi Joseph teaches at Youth Speaks, mentoring young writers in San Francisco. He's spoken at more than 100 colleges around the country. He's performed on stage with some of the leading voices of our time. He's also the recipient of a Rockefeller Fellowship, which is bestowed on the country's greatest living artists. Mark Bamuthi Joseph, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Wow, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's an incredible resume, I got to say. I read somewhere on the web, as I was researching for this interview, that you said you've been performing since you were five.
This is true.
How'd you get going?
My parents, recent immigrants, or relatively recent immigrants to the United States, had two precocious young children running around, and my younger sister was just so cute that friends of my parents suggested that they take her into a commercial manager to do commercial and print work. And on the day they brought her in, they couldn't find a babysitter for me. And so I went with them and charmed the manager in my six-year-old way. And he... you know, told my parents that I should probably audition for some commercial work as well. And so I booked my first commercial at 5 or 6 years old and have...
What was the commercial for?
It was for, man, I don't even want to shout out Procter and Gamble like that, but you know, just so you know, if you've brushed your teeth with it, if you've clogged your arteries with it, I've hawked it.
And then you got on Broadway early on, too, I hear.
Yes, yeah. I was really fortunate at 10 years old to be a part of the company of the Tap Dance Kid, where I was able to work with artists like Hinton Battle and Harold Nicholas and the esteemed Savion Glover. And that was my first foray into theater. And hung with theater pretty tough between 10 and, let's say, 18 years old. And those formative years really informed my approach to the classroom and also my positioning relative to commercial art.
And you decided not to really stay on Broadway and do the Broadway total acting thing, though, for some reason.
No, man. I was into girls and soccer and eventually into my own education. And so performance became something that was recreational for me and also something that I could reach back to as I left undergrad at Morehouse College and entered the classroom as a 10th grade English teacher. And so every now and then, you know, in the middle of a Great Gatsby passage, I could just start pulling pirouettes to grab my, you know, kids' attention. Or, you know, I was also coaching the soccer team at the time. And so just kind of my motivational prowess, I think, was also steeped in this background in performance.
So you dove into a spoken word performance.
Yes.
And you do it in a very theatrical way from what I've seen on the internet, with a lot of dance in there too. Mm-hmm. Was spoken word as a form sitting out there and already being popular when you started to participate in it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the form, you know, if I were to give a fairly long lineage, maybe a 60-year lineage, I'd begin with the beat poets in San Francisco, and Ginsberg and Kerouac and Diane DePrima had you know, and Leroy Jones. And Leroy Jones became Amiri Baraka, who's our link between the Beats movement and the Black Arts movement. And you have Baraka and Sonia Sanchez and Nikki Giovanni, Etheridge Knight, Donnell Lee. You know, you have that cadre of poets that gives way to Miguel Pinheiro and Miguel Algarine and
the New York poets.
You know, exactly. Yeah. So you have poets. The New Yorican poets, you have Entezaki Shange, right? So you have this crossover as well between the New Yorican poets and what Joe Papp was doing at the Public Theater. And you have that opening up to hip hop music and, you know, Grandmaster Flash and, you know, and the Furious Five and The Message, which was released in 1982. And you have that opening up to Rakim, and you have Rakim opening up to Nas, and then you have Nas opening up to a man named Saul Williams, you know, and this is obviously a truncated genealogy.
It's a great curriculum,
you know, but Saul Williams is really a crossroads figure in my life, and I think in the lives of many folks, because he really represented the intersection of hip hop culture and spoken word cultures, you know, originated in the Beats. So this was 96. I graduated in 97, and there was a movie that came out called Poetic License. And this was a documentary film by Dave Yanofsky that documented the youth poetry movement as well. So all this was happening at the same time that Mark Levin released a film, Slam. All this was happening in the late 90s. And so it was a great time to, you know, to land.
Could you give us a sample of one of your spoken word pieces, just for people who are listening? If you're listening in your car or in your living room or in your kitchen, this is a taste of spoken word.
A taste of spoken word. All right. Danger, danger. This is an African-descended alphabetic assassin with an oral range. I arrange African and American oral idioms. I'm all up in them. I'm bending them. Cinnamon sweet like train blue high seas. We've left Pisces. There's a new age on the horizon. I represent 36 dimes. My mind inscribes ribbons in the sky that you might mistake for dog stars rising, third eye and wise. And that's not all. I juggle cultures like clowns juggling balls at peep shows. Ethos, deconstruction of egos. I seek those who slash sound. Negro who mask nouns is and verbs under. Whew. Because the way that I move speaks volumes. That ain't new to you, but view the weight on my shoulders is a chip that comes with thick lips, brown skin, and grammar-defying flips. Verbal automatic spray with infinite clips that gets clipped by my least favorite adjectival quip. Wow, you're so articulate. I hate that ish. It's not the sentiment that's wrong. Right on to all affirmations and attempts to bridge gaps. Perhaps I'm just projecting, but the compliment folks pay me comes from some whole other section. Teach me to reach. Respect me like mother's nectar. But let me articulate vexation at limiting vector when folks represent black male image projector and I am the screen, seen in two dimensions. Paranoid inventions, intentions may be all good, but underneath articulations of, wow, you're so articulate, is this tonal implication inquiring, how does manchild in unpromised hood manage to compose cogent thoughts as lucid language? Languid lexiconic phonics and phonemes gave accessibility to King's dream, but things seem seamlessly shameful. I ain't got a name for it. It's just an observation. The surprise in folks' voice when dexterity of verbal articulations matches Swift's move of killer crossover move or kitchen floor gloss over move. It's like their theories to prove that all black men should sound like Leon Spinks or worse, the genuine awe around black men who think. Say, token Negro, tell me what you think about insert race-related inquiry here. And I concede W.E.B., Ralph Ellis, and a whole crew else had it right when they talked about double consciousness and black invisible self impeding full absorption of praise for performance. It's an unfortunate psychic trauma derived from the drama, the Middle Passage, slavery, yada, yada, you know, deal. Okay. Feel me on this. We are an oral people. The word is our gift. From griots to MCs, we supposed to be articulate. More info is passed in Harlem on 135th and 5th and 6 CNNs and an internet, but yet there's this subtle shock around those Negroes who don't use the word yo like commas, yo, know what I'm saying? It's like the status quo still ain't heard. You got Baldwin, Morrison, Locke, all masses of the word that we observe as articulate, presenting this reality that the mind has not met. And I am sure back in the day, some Alabama slave turned to his owner to say massa. It behooves me to respectfully request that subsequent floggings be limited to 12 score lashes. I know you deem a us bereft of all humanity, but I must remind you that even a beast has its limits. Negro Bennett probably caught a minute of fame on the abolitionist set, but the ill thing is that the whoopings ain't ended yet. Instead, you got Jesse Jackson or Cornel West articulating pain and rage in the black community after every other brother's race-related death. Danger, danger. This is an African-descended alphabetic assassin with an oral range. Rage, 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 danger. African-American sick of articulating pain.
Wow, that's Mark Bamuti Joseph. What is the title of that work? That's amazing.
Let's call that Articulate.
Seems like an obvious one. Once I guess I should have thought of that one myself. Slashing sound, though, that is really what you're doing a lot with your spoken word, which is so interesting. Not only the way you string the words together and the power and the different emotions, the different pace and the different volume, but just the wordplay is so great.
Thank you, man.
Where could people find that if they wanted to go find that? Is that on the web?
Not that particular piece, but the three sites that I would direct folks to are youthspeaks.org, youthspeaks.org, which is the hub for the literary arts organization that a cadre of colleagues and I have been developing over the course of the last 13 years. And the second site that I would direct folks to is lifeisliving.org, LIFEISLIVING, lifeisliving.org, which presents a vision of new vocabulary of affirming life in urban communities as a pathway towards environmental stewardship. And that's actually the project that I'm most proud of. And then just for general information about me, just follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BAMUTHI, Bamuti.
Yeah, and the full name is Mark with a C, Mark Bamuti Joseph. And Bamuti is spelled BAMUTHI. You were talking about the thing you're most proud of. Why don't you elaborate on that?
Well, Life is Living is a national campaign, a storytelling campaign that is rooted in the idea of eco-centered hip-hop festivals that we produce around the country so far in Houston, in Chicago, in New York, and in Oakland. And we cohere community-based organizations, community partners, and large institutions from the University of Houston to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago to Riverside Church in Harlem. And we work with these partners to activate underused parks or underutilized parks in underserved neighborhoods, placing hip hop as center, but redirecting the messaging around environmentalism so that it includes and affirms activities of everyday life. So, so at a Life is Living festival, you're likely to see, you know, Mos Def perform or Pharoah Monch perform. There'll be graffiti battles, but there'll also be Healthy Earth, healthy body modules. There'll be tree plantings. There'll be urban gardening expositions. There'll be town halls on healthcare. So we've taken a pretty holistic approach to environmentalism and environmental stewardship, really focusing on centering environmental activity around life itself.
And for more information, people go to lifeisliving.org, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. Oh,
that's fascinating. Now, you told me, Mark Bamuti Joseph, that you're just back from Sudan. What was that like?
I had the great privilege 3 weeks ago to travel to Khartoum in Sudan, East Africa. I was there 10 days. When I left, they were about a week out from their first democratic elections, or quote-unquote democratic elections, in more than 20 years. And I was curated into a festival in Khartoum. And so I was able to teach workshops to the theater department, to kids in the theater department at University of Sudan. I was able to perform at the National Theater, which is right on the banks of the Nile in Khartoum, and engage with this really volatile, complex, you know, region of the planet.
Was it like to be with students, try to teach students who've lived through a horrible civil war? And some of them must have terrible personal memories.
Yeah, you know, well, this is the liberatory pedagogy as espoused by, you know, the great Paulo Freire, among other visionary educators. But this was liberatory pedagogy at work, you know, particularly in a repressive regime as far as communication, you know, is concerned. And, you know, we were able, my partner Jai Jackson and I, we were able to use music and poetry and movement as a tool for, you know, I would say radical expression, you know, and certainly within the safe confines of art, I think we were able to enable the young people to kind of access a path of self-discovery and
maybe a path of healing too.
Yeah, certainly. And political engagement, you know, that was kind of undercover of the color of music.
And you wrote a poem, you said, on the way back. Do you want to?
I did.
You want to do that? You're reading it off your phone, which is an amazing thing.
I did. Yeah. So I wrote this poem on the flight back from Sudan.
So this is Mark Bamuti Joseph.
In the last gasp of evening, somewhere in the Sudanese middle distance, dogs assail the night with deep-throated, mean-willed bark. Hung in the air like a falling star, exhaust smoke holding cinnamon and cardamom and ash in its folds. In the near dark, I am clutching at jagged memory to grasp my newfound whiteness. My first point of access is the name of a second grader who goes to school with my son, Sudan. Her parents place the old Arabic word meaning land of the blacks upon her head. Grow into this child, oil-rich Mecca midpoint, bush beats black, Sudan. My second clue is the iTunes ubiquity of the word Darfur, which I know George Clooney and Madonna really care about, and I know Lost Boys and Genocide, but I don't know why they're lost, and I don't know who's killing who. A Starbucks activist, I know what I read between the door and my dirty soy chai, but I do know that I found clue number 3 last summer in the shaking voice of a mother tongue, just now loosened in the still dark shadow of the loss of her son. Inner city school kid, life violently left invalid, gun blast, book bag, blood soaked, Chicago morning. In the near dark, the sound of shouting at an intersection without signal lights, the smell of perfumed oil seeped into wood amid burning trash and cleansing, sharp dust, stray cats, loose collections of physics-resistant prayer songs, men touch each other with palm syntax as synapse incensed by the faint scent of danger, 6 of us standing on a riverbank at an apex where the Blue Nile and White Nile meet, northern Sudan, we sharing rolled stems, brown leaves, and seeds. The darkest among us is the color of solar eclipse. His skin is crisp like the center of my heartbroken iris, kissed living placenta planted in Nile papyrus, just on the other side of blue, black, Sudan. The men dandelion blow their way through an explanation of Darfur like first-timers at an AA meeting, resigned to the reality at odds with the idea. The government funds militia to displace the least among us, draw borders in blood where bonds of brotherhood might be. Difference, they say, is skin deep. Looking around and gesturing, the man who looks most like me says we are all considered white here. Now pointing, except him. A storm of bashful ivory breaks the seal of the eclipse's lips. Miraculously, at the river, there is a nigger among us, and I am closer to white than I have ever been. I am prescribed to vision American diversity. I see the chromatic logic of ethnic cleansing with untrained lens. My paradigm for race is civil rights and apartheid-based, us and them. Chicago Morning made the smart play. She moved her family from southern Sudan as a Jew would have left 1930s Germany while the sound of slaughter was still hushed in the soft horizon. A civil war, blood for oil, north and south, brown and black. I meet her in uptown Chicago marching toward Clarendon Park. We are memorializing the lives of 36 youth murdered during the previous school year. Her son is among them. Leaving the continent's worst ever civil war, her son fell victim to another self-perpetuated pandemic assault on black life. She walks at the front of the vigil holding his picture in a simple black frame. If you look real close, you can see he has about 21, maybe 27 and a half hairs on his chin. At first, you miss the hair because the first thing you notice is his skin. If it were soil, his is the earth brown you'd want to sow in. A Chicago sun, hard times, he does not blink. So think of this brother Brown. Now see this mother dressed in black. See how dark the day becomes when you bury the sun. How you set the future back. A mother inters a murdered teen. The six of us stand at the Nile on higher ground. I am looking at color in the primitive way that we traumatized American blacks do. If a race war broke out in this room right now, it'd be easier to gauge my odds and figure out who I'd have to knock out. We see in binary suppositions here. I know the sides. We have five races. In Sudan, they see 300 tribes, and because I am not among the lowest here at the Nile, in the seed of black civilization, I am most near to white. Cultural economies of scale, class divides, blood for oil, genocides. Instinctively, I want to assign the role of the bad guy, put him in a black hat, spy versus spy, burn him like a fire in Chicago, right outside the window, scorch him like a windpipe worn from screaming from the burning of your kinfolk like intifada by the border between Brahmins. Look real close. Among the six, there are shysters and there are shamans. Wrapping the body like a blues around the throat of a broken promise. Titanic climactic chaos prophecy. The Brahmins bombing heated thunder up your bigger Thomas. Clueless, I wish to claim an enemy. Derive familiar directions from a psychological map, always pointing me to this moment when my color works for me. Never so basic as a mother's morning tears. Never so simple as anything you could read while waiting for coffee in black and white.
Mark Bamuti Joseph, reciting, reading, performing a new poem he just wrote on his way back from a trip to the Sudan. He was reading it off his phone because that's the only copy he seems to have, because he emailed it on his way back and he got it on his phone. So there's so much in that poem. So many things come up, especially, one of those is certainly the tragedy of that poor mom from the Sudan who escaped the Civil War only to come to Chicago and have her son killed.
Right.
Wow. You call yourself there a Starbucks activist. Certainly that is not who you are.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I would like to approach the depth of the majority of your listeners and, you know, the readers of Progressive Magazine. And this is a community living in the Bay Area, being so close, you know, to our Pacifica radio station, KPFA, and interacting with the great, you know, Amy Goodman and, you know, the cadre of journalists and media activists, you know, Davey D and Waylon Southern that, you know, that work at Pacifica. I've had a great period, I think, of mind expansion. And so,
did you know Andrea Lewis there? She wrote for the Progressive. She died just a few months ago, and that was a tragedy.
Yes.
And yeah. She had a great voice of her own, both a radio voice and a singing voice.
Yeah, and I was honored to be on the morning show with her probably 3 months before she passed. And so, I do know Andrea, you know, and I speak in the present tense, you know, about folks who physically have left us, have transitioned, including, you know, the great Dorothy Height, who we lost a few days ago, and the MC Guru, but they are still among us.
We only have about 5 minutes left. I wonder if you want to do another one or if you want to just talk.
Let's just talk.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. You must be exhausted. Those things are exhausting. One of the things you do is teach.
Yes,
and
sir.
I want to hear about that because maybe because I always wanted to be a teacher and never quite did it, but also because I think you're doing interesting things with teaching. So tell the person who's listening in our car or kitchen or in his office about Youth Speaks and the kind of teaching you do.
Well, Youth Speaks is a 13-year-old nonprofit organization whose mission essentially is to provide space for the next generation of leaders to develop their skills through the finding, development, public presentation, and application of voice. You know, our goal is to democratize public discourse through the poetic form. And the mechanism for that is primarily visits to every high school in the Bay Area, where we reach more than 50,000 kids per year. And also through hosting and producing an annual youth poetry festival called Brave New Voices. And as you mentioned earlier, Brave New Voices was documented in a 7-part series by Russell Simmons and Stan Lathan and presented on HBO in 2009. They're actually coming back to document the 2011 or 2010 iteration of Brave New Voices. Which
I was wondering, so that's going to be on TV again.
Exactly, exactly. So every year we're in a different city. You know, the year on HBO, we were in Washington, D.C. Last year we were in Chicago. This year we're in Los Angeles. Next year we're in San Francisco. And there's a team from Madison and Milwaukee where we're recording this interview that, you know, that shows up. And more than 500 kids from as far away as Guam and Egypt, you know, show up for this festival.
You know, it's interesting, Mark Bamuti-Joseph, who's my guest today on Progressive Radio, and I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio, of course. You talk about democratizing the discourse, and I find that to be a crucial concept and a crucial task because the discourse in so many, I mean, look at poetry.
Right.
Poetry used to be a really hermetically sealed kind of experiment
that
only people who went to, you know, the Iowa Writing Workshop and a few other places could actually get a key to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And so spoken word has really opened the doors of poetry to people to access all over the country, and then when it gets on TV, but also democratizing the political discourse.
Absolutely. You know, and that's what we hope for. You know, it's very interesting that you described that kind of sterility, let's say, of the poetic medium, you know, after more than a few decades of being hijacked by the academy. James Cass, who is an alum of University of Wisconsin here in Madison, started Youth Speaks with exactly that idea in mind while still a grad school and still in grad school at the Creative Writing Department at San Francisco State. And it's been amazing to watch that idea flourish and to be able to you know, teach this pedagogy, not only here, but across the country at Stanford, at Lehigh, and so forth.
Well, you're a champion of the spoken word and one of the great teachers of spoken word, a real ambassador.
Thank you
for
brother.
Spoken word. Mark Bamuti-Joseph has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. You can find out more about him and his work at youthspeaks.org and more about the work he's doing to bring kind of echo spoken word out there at lifeisliving.org. Mark Bamuti-Joseph, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, family.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.